We all know a great story when we hear it. Can make us cry, can make us laugh, can make us think. But what is a story? David Freudberg's thought a lot about what a story is. He's written and edited more than 90 full-length radio documentaries. Freudberg says the human story is not just entertainment or information. He believes our stories address and call forth the highest part of people. And Strange Champs asked Freudberg why he spent the last 25 years of his life on other people's stories.
Well, I think we all crave stories from the time we're children listening to our parents or grandparents tell us stories. And I think it's the way that we all seem to get through life. I'm always looking for the universal that underlies what appears to be on the surface, because I think that's what nourishes me the most and what is closest to the truth of any situation. It is the force that's driving people, that's motivating them, the thing that they wake up in the middle of the night thinking about, the glue that keeps them together when the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune assail them. And sometimes they change the world.
For example, you brought some tape in with you today, didn't you?
Yes. Well, one of the people who just astonished me was a woman named Doris Haddock, who has become affectionately known across the country as Granny D, and who seems to draw supporters from all sides of the aisle, and who has made a singular commitment to changing the way our elections are done in this country. And she actually walked across the United States in a kind of symbolic gesture. And I thought this was such an improbable story that I should try to seek her out. And it turned out she was just a couple hours north of our studio outside of Boston. She's in the town of Dublin, New Hampshire. And it seemed like it would really be worth going up to see her. And it certainly was.
This is the route that I took.
Started in Santa Monica,
yeah.
and cut a swath through
Arizona,
the Southwest, Texas, and then sort of made your way through Arkansas up to
Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and to West Virginia,
and then to Washington D.C.
Washington D.C. Right.
Barely 5 feet tall and donning a broad-brimmed straw hat, Granny D set out on her late-in-life odyssey against what might have seemed heavy odds. She is sometimes afflicted with emphysema and arthritis and wears a back brace. But she was propelled by the power of belief.
How can you live with something to know what is happening in this country? It's not an easy thing to do. It's not easy to say that our democracy, of, by and for the people, has gone down the drain. We've sold it out.
But how do you respond when people say it's still a great country?
Of course it's a great country.
There's a lot of freedom here. There's a lot of opportunity to succeed.
More than in any other country in the world. But it's not a democracy. And it's getting worse. This is the problem. It's getting worse. And if we don't do something about it and do it fast, then we've lost it. I'm thinking about the legacy. I have 16 great-grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I want them to live in a democracy.
Talk about the power of belief. I mean, you say that actually for a lot of this, she was wearing a back brace during a lot of this walking she did.
I think she began this in her late 80s and ended her walk in the year when she turned 90. And she has arthritis and emphysema, and she just kept battling. She was unable to be vanquished. And the fact of her endurance was so powerful. But when you talked with her to find out why she was so bent on making this public statement, it became clear that it was really coming out of a very deep belief that she held.
You know, we were talking about your attraction to universal themes in people's stories. Do you feel like the people you interview, the people you profile, are all like living examples of, you know, the Joseph Campbell sort of hero's journey? Because a lot of them are people who, you know, have faced extraordinary odds and they've arrived at something.
One of the people we talked to was a young man named Matty Stepanek, who actually passed away in 2004 at age 13, but not before writing two New York Times bestsellers. He was a young, disabled fellow whose family had been really almost destroyed by muscular dystrophy. All of his three siblings had passed away of it. His mother was in a wheelchair the day I came to their basement apartment outside of Baltimore. Matty himself was in a wheelchair, and he had a trach, a tube that went into his throat, which made it very difficult for him to speak, and he actually gasps for breath every few words, as you will hear.
Well, I'm not the only disabled kid in the world. There's a lot of people, not just kids, that are sick in some way. And a lot of them are very sad about life, feeling down in the dumps. And I tell them, appreciate every moment of life. Because even though you live forever in a better place after you die, you should enjoy life on Earth while it lasts. And don't spend whatever time you have on Earth sitting in a corner feeling miserable for yourself. Remember to play after every storm. That's my life philosophy.
What does it mean to play after every storm?
Well, it means we all have life storms, times in our lives that are extremely sad, scary, angry. And instead of just suffering through them and then afterwards just sitting, crying, and waiting to be wiped out by the next one, we should celebrate together that we got through. Then when the next one comes along, work through and pull through and celebrate again. And always remember the bad times, but never dwell on them.
Is it tempting sometimes to just really feel sorry for yourself? Does it ever get you down?
Oh, yes. I get sad, scary, even sometimes angry, but I don't dwell on it. I don't just curl up and wait to die. I live every second of my life. I talk both publicly and a lot at home. I have fun. I'm a normal kid, and I always live life to the fullest. And I not only fight this disease, I triumph over it.
Triumph over it means?
Not to dwell on it, not to just say, I'm sick, my life is terrible, I can't run around and jump, I can't dive into the pool. I rather say, I can't run around, but I can sure as heck roll around pretty fast. I can't dive into the pool, but I can get a water gun and squirt people. So I always see my glass half full, not half empty. Because if we see our glasses as half empty, they may as well be empty all the way.
You know, I just hearing Matty breathe just about breaks your heart. Was it hard for you to do that interview?
You know, Anne, I will have to say that it was the hardest interview I've conducted in my life, and I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I was so choked up that it was hard for me to get questions out. And what I was reacting to so strongly was the beauty of his message. It really felt to me like this was some old sage who had come back into a broken boy's body for a few short years to teach the rest of us about patience, about maintaining a positive attitude in the face of adversity, about peacemaking. He said something to me that morning that has stuck with me every day, although I will admit in racing through traffic to get to the studio here today to record our interview, I probably didn't remember it as well as I should have. Matty said, always let someone else get in line in front of you. And it was such a simple statement of deference and courtesy, but if we all followed that, and particularly if those of us who drive on the roadways around Boston followed it, I think we would have a much more peaceful world.
Hmm. You know, there's a school of psychology, I think it's called narrative psychology, that looks specifically at how we tell our own stories. You know, so if somebody asks you, tell me about yourself or tell me about your childhood, you're going to pick specific memories from your past to give me. And those stories are what you use to construct your own identity. So a narrative therapist might encourage you to change those stories, and by doing that, change yourself. But I'm interested in the kinds of stories we choose to tell about ourselves as we construct our lives. And I was struck listening to some of the profiles you've done that very often there are defining moments in people's lives that they look back on. You know, when they're telling you the story of their life and who they are, there's this moment that really kind of sums up a lot of who they are.
Well, first of all, I'm kind of amused by the idea of a narrative therapist. It sounds like I should book an appointment as soon as possible.
Maybe you are one.
That's even scarier. But, oh, yes, we all have these profound turning points that in many ways define who we become. And those pivotal moments, which are often very painful, can turn out to be blessings in disguise. And I'm fascinated by people who walk through those moments with great courage.
You know, the piece of yours I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about the interview you did with the Unabomber's brother.
Mm. Well, I remembered that it was the brother himself who ended up turning in Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, to the federal authorities. And I thought, everybody's focusing on the horror of this terrorist, but the much more interesting story, in a sense, was the brother who had to wrestle in a kind of dark night of the soul with his conscience, torn on the one hand between a natural love one would have for his brother, and on the other hand, torn by the need to protect society from someone who wished ill. I wanted to really understand how you would sort out such a deep emotional conflict like that. How did your mother walk through all this?
You know, I think we had wanted to spare her for as long as possible. Again, even when we approached the FBI, we didn't feel certain that Ted was responsible. We hoped that they would find some way to rule him out as a suspect. Eventually, I got the call I'd been dreading. An agent that we'd been working closely with said, David, we've done everything possible to rule out your brother as a suspect. Unfortunately, he's moved to the top of our suspect list, and we're now at a point in the investigation where we need to speak with your mom. Do you think you could arrange an interview for us? So I remember going to her apartment. It was on a Saturday morning. She opened the door, and I saw her face change. So obviously my anguish must have been written all over me. And she said, David, something's wrong. You've got to tell me. What is it? And I said, yeah, Mom, I think you better sit down. Her first reaction was a mother's reaction, perhaps a mother's intuition, is it's Ted. Is it something about Ted? And I said, well, Mom, as far as I know, he's in good health, but I do have something very troubling to tell you. She sat down in this little lazy boy chair where I always picture her reading or watching television. I was much too agitated to sit down. I was kind of pacing the room back and forth, trying to find some way to deliver this news painlessly, but there was no way to do that. Before long, I'm crying a little bit. Mom's just sitting in that chair, not saying a word, looking at me with this fixed look of horror on her face. And you know, I'm realizing not many relationships are tested in quite this cruel way. How could I be certain she'd even love me after I told her what I'd done? I kind of got to the end of what I had to say and said, Mom, I think there's a chance Ted might be involved. Mom, I've even taken the step of calling the FBI, and they're currently investigating him. And I'll always remember what Mom did next. I mean, it was just extraordinary, a real extraordinary gesture. She got up out of her chair, and she's a very small woman. I'm a little over 6 feet tall. She's a little under 5 feet tall. And she walked up to me, reached up her arms around my neck, and put a kiss on my cheek. And the first thing she said was, David, I can't imagine what you've been going through. Extraordinary to me that in this most terrible moment, her first concern was for my feelings. And then she said probably the most comforting things I could have heard. She said, David, I know that you love Ted. I know that you wouldn't have done this unless you felt like you had to.
That's one of the most moving pieces of tape I've heard. I mean, just the quality of love in the mother's response and in the brother's struggle also, but that's very beautiful.
Well, it occurred to me that the story had so many levels to it. On the surface was the level of, you know, capturing a domestic terrorist. But there was bravery. There was a willingness to put right in front of mere family attachments. There was an amazing dimension of forgiveness. And by the way, this was very painful and continues to be for David, because his brother Ted has refused to speak to David ever since David turned him in and would not make eye contact with him at the federal legal proceedings. And it was just an amazingly bold life that he's chosen to lead.
David, you've been making documentaries and profiles like this for a long time now, and I'm interested in what you've been doing because there's kind of a bigger collective story emerging that's being constructed out of all of the little stories, the smaller stories that you've been making all these years. Do you feel that the kind of stories you tell are your own particular way of trying to change the world?
I am a giant believer in the power of knowledge and information. I really think that the framers of our Constitution had it right when they embedded into the whole system the exchange of ideas in a free society. And I do basically believe, however misinformed sometimes people may be, or however close-minded they may sometimes be, that if we can expose constructive, meaningful, good ideas to the light and allow people to ponder them, that it can hugely change the way communities are run and the way a whole society is run.
David Freudberg is the executive producer at Human Media. He's written and edited more than 90 full-length radio documentaries. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him.